Hi! Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm Kay Albert Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is based on one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? Answering that question led me on a deep dive into the history of my faith tradition as an evangelical Christian, and it was in that deep dive I encountered for the first time the Catholic Church in her own words, actual Catholic authors and theologians and speakers and priests of all people. It was then that I realized that what I thought I knew about Catholicism was based in large part on misinformation and more often than not on simple misunderstandings. Well, this show serves to fill in that same gap, the gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the heart of the Catholic Church, and this episode, this is an important episode for just that purpose. My guest this week is Dr. Abigail Favalli, who's written at length for a long time in the field of her expertise in gender and sexuality. And this episode is all about what the Catholic Church, what Catholics should and do believe about gender and sexuality. It's so important to get this right, I think. And we're a critical time in place in our society, and we as Catholics need to speak properly about these topics from a place of faith, love, and understanding. That's where we are today in this conversation. If you want a primer on what Catholics believe about sexuality and gender, I think this is the one for you. It's fantastic. I hope you enjoy. This conversation and others are brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. If you want to support the work of this show on a monthly basis, head over there and check that out and see how you can support the thing that this is. The thing that I'm trying to make this, that I'm trying to be docile and get out of the way to let God use this instrument. If you believe in that mission, head over there. Links are in the show notes on how you can support this show. And thank you. And now, without any further ado, my conversation with Dr. Abigail Favalli. I get a little feisty in this one, guys. I apologize. Please listen and enjoy. Hey friends, thanks for being here. Thanks for watching. Thank you for listening. If you're listening on podcast, thank you. Welcome. We're also on YouTube at youtube.com/thecordialcatholic. If you want to watch, for some reason, what you're listening to, that'd be awesome. On either platform, make sure you hit the subscribe button. And on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, please leave a rating or review. That helps to push the podcast out to new people. And everyone needs more of Abigail Favalli in their lives. Let's be honest. I am joined by Dr. Abigail Favalli. She is a professor at the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. Congrats, by the way.
Thanks.
The author of Into the Deep, a wonderful exploration of her conversion to Catholicism, and for our purposes here today, The Genesis of Gender, out from Ignatius Press. Dr. Favalli, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here, and hello.
Yeah. Hi.
I should say welcome back to the show. I don't know if you remember this, but...
I do.
Good golly. I looked back in the archives and I had to keep scrolling back because it was episode 18 of the show, about 150 episodes ago, three and a half years ago, that you were on this program, which feels like, I don't know, we're getting old or I'm getting old or my memory is not working or something. You had, I think, just written an article for... Actually, I think I got in touch with you before the article came out, and it came out between getting in touch with you and you appearing on the show, which is my luck, for the Church Life Journal at Notre Dame about gender and sexuality. And I remember when I first read that article and it started getting passed around the circles that I kind of associate with, thinking, wow, somebody has finally kind of put words to what we as Catholics believe and why it's beautiful and why it makes sense and why it is such a contrast to some of the things that other people in the world, the current kind of ethos or zeitgeist or the paradigm is saying. You made so much sense of that for us. And I remember just passing that along and for a long time, and even I stink, that's true. But even I think as recently as like last month, somebody asked me for a good explanation of gender and sexuality from the Catholic perspective. And I went back and found your article and passed it along again because it was just so poignant. This book has expanded on those ideas and those themes, and we have to say thank you for doing that, because the work you are doing, I think singularly, is not being done in a lot of places. You're clear, you're articulate, you're Catholic, you're funny, you're ready to throw some punches, pull some punches. I don't know.
Depends on the day.
Punch people, I guess. Maybe this is the wrong show for that.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I'm very cordial most of the time.
That's good. I don't know. Well, thank you. Thank you for all your work, I want to say. And I want to know, I wonder if you can begin by kind of outlining, because you aren't just some slum. Gosh, it's going to be a long show, Abby. I'm sorry.
You're totally fine.
Why am I calling you Abby? We're not like...
No, you should call me Abby.
Should I?
Because it makes me feel awkward. Okay. I'm going to close out all the windows of my browser just to make sure not... I've become one of those like hoarder browser window people. Yeah. Okay, there we go.
Abby, stop calling.
No, please do call. I know.
I don't know you that well to call you. Anyway,
it's fine.
Now I do. I just crossed
that. This is my second appearance.
Sure.
I feel like,
you know what, that's true. Yeah. I know you way back when. Look, like you came on the show.
You know
me
before COVID.
Yeah, before that. Really? Wow.
That's how long ago it was. Yeah.
My goodness. Wow. Okay. We have changed a lot, haven't we, since then?
We go way back.
My goodness. Mm-hmm. All right. So I want to know, because what I was trying to say is you have credentials in this field. You're not just some person who's walked up the street to begin opening up a YouTube channel and commenting on these things as some people out there are doing and have done. You are in this space, writing about this space, researching this space, doing work in this space, and you've written from a place of knowledge and understanding. So I want to ask you, first of all, to lay out your credentials for us. Kind of tell us how you began, because the first part of the book really outlines kind of how you got involved in this and your kind of evolution of thinking, thinking through that. And one, where I want you to end, if I can steer you a little bit in this direction, is the one theme of this I thought was so interesting is you kind of end the section with this, I think, maybe, or maybe I'm getting the book mixed up, but you say feminism led you away from and then toward a deep Christian faith. I think that's so interesting. So can you kind of take us through that journey a little bit, just to give listeners a sense of who you are and where you're coming from with this this writing on gender and sexuality and those kinds of things?
Yeah, sure. So I started getting really into feminist thought in college as an undergraduate. So I was raised an evangelical Protestant. Feminism was not really on the radar, but I was interested in questions of gender. I don't know if I would have used that term back then, but from a young age. And when I encountered feminist thought in college, I thought, oh, this is amazing. I love this. You know, I was a philosophy major, but I began to really get into feminist philosophy. But I also loved women's writing and literature, so it was hard for me to choose. So then I went on into graduate school at St. Andrews in Scotland, and a master's in women's writing and gender theory, because I thought this will help me decide whether I want to like go straight into sort of feminist philosophy or do more like feminist philosophy and literature. And I loved it. I loved the combination of the two. And so I stayed on in that field to do a PhD in women's writing and feminist literary criticism. And I worked primarily using French feminist philosophy. So if any of your listeners are familiar with that field, like Lucie Rigoré was my main feminist philosopher that I worked with, and actually got to meet her and work with her. And I've published with her, as well. So she's quite well known in the Anglo-American world.
So, sorry. Yeah, no.
No, go ahead. So, but to kind of loop back to that question, I think initially feminism took me away from my faith because I basically, by immersing myself in feminist thought, I kind of adopted this hermeneutics of suspicion, this way of reading everything, like reality, but certainly the Bible, certainly tradition, through with this suspicious kind of ready to do a scavenger hunt for sexism kind of mentality. And so I think that disposition became kind of a wall between myself and God, right? Because you can't really trust or love someone that you're at root very deeply suspicious of. So that, I think, put me at odds with Christianity, even though I still considered myself to be a Christian. But the way it led me back was actually getting deeper. This is in my doctoral work, into the thought of Lucie Rigoré, this feminist philosopher I mentioned, because She talks a lot about incarnation in her work. She's actually raised Catholic, although, you know, was not practicing or anything, but had kind of in her later work returned to Catholicism and looking for some kind of fruitful things within it. And I went to this seminar with her, with 10 other doctoral students from around the world. And at the time I was planning to focus on imagination, this concept of maybe the theological imagination of women writers, something like that. But instead she was like, no, don't focus on imagination. It's too abstract. Like, focus on incarnation. Like, you know, and I was like, ooh, I like that, you know. And then it turns out like that was really this, you know, focus on incarnation, you know, was one of the primary things that led me toward Catholicism. So
I thought that's so interesting. I mean, you talk in the book about how you didn't necessarily, I don't think, leave your evangelical Christianity behind, but you became more and more skeptical of it. And mm-hmm. you were still exploring the edges of that, right, in this work. But then I think that's so fascinating. I think one of the things that that struck me is, I think, and maybe I'm getting you entirely wrong, and that's possible, the thought is we can't as Christians, as Catholics, just reject feminism, right? And say, no, this is not important. This is a stupid thing. Because for you, that was a thing that brought you back to the faith. That was a real tangible thing. And if we just write that off and say, oh, I have no time for this. If you're a feminist, like, goodbye. Sorry, the church isn't a place for you. Mm-hmm. We're not going to try and reach or talk to these people or pay attention to them. This is a silly thing. There's a whole segment of society that we're not even interacting with. Is that fair to say? Like, this is a serious thing we have to grapple with.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I would even maybe even go a step further in that I think as Catholics, we get to be generous toward any system of thought because we can look for what's true and find what's true. And that doesn't mean buying the whole thing, right? So, you know, like Thomas Aquinas, this was his method. He didn't say, oh, those Islamic philosophers, I'm not going to read them because they don't, you know, believe in the incarnation. Like, no, he understood his own faith more deeply by studying Avicenna, you know, or Maimonides, the Jewish philosopher, right? So, or the pagan philosophers, of course, Aristotle was like his dude. So he wasn't like, I'm not going to read the pagans. So I do think you gotta strike a balance, right? There's either the unthinking acceptance, which I think I did initially, which was not good. But then there's also the knee-jerk reaction against, like, the rejection. Just there's nothing of value here, which I think is an overreaction.
So I'm thinking about, because you were nominally an evangelical Christian when you began this, but you ended up that kind of journey as a Catholic. The incarnation was part of that, and studying that. What I wonder if you could articulate what in the incarnation drew you towards Catholicism versus back to your roots as an evangelical Christian. Like, was there something in there that, as you grapple with that idea and feminism, wouldn't bring you back to the Bible alone believing evangelical Christianity? Like, what was that that drew you to the Catholic faith?
Well, I mean, not to throw my dear evangelical friends under the bus, but I guess I would say that evangelical Christianity is not as incarnational as Catholicism, right? I mean, I really think if you, and this isn't even unique to evangelicalism per se, but I think if you kind of step back and look at the things that were rejected in the Reformation by and large, they tend to be the things that are more feminine and more incarnational, the things that have to do more with the body, right? So you have the rejection of the Eucharist and the sacraments, right, which are very bodily and incarnational. You have the rejection of Mary. You have the rejection of the church as a visible mother on earth. You have a rejection of the communion of saints. It's, you know, like, if you think about when you walk into a Catholic space, you're just like, you know, bombarded with bodies. It's like there's statues everywhere. Yeah. And so I felt when I went into a Catholic space, even though I had all these, you know, feminist objections, I felt like that it was showing me this fullness of Christianity that I had not encountered as growing up evangelical. Like, I think that the evangelical churches that I worshipped in, like, they had the word, but they didn't have the word made flesh, you know, and that's what I wanted.
Yeah, and I guess for me, because I was this was a pointed question. I didn't do a serious study as you did, but this for me was one of those things I was grappling with as a non-denominational evangelical Christian. And I found, I don't know if you found the same thing, but there wasn't serious work being done in these areas in the evangelical church. It was kind of, there were books and theologians and conferences that kind of presented different pieces of scripture and interpretations of things that would talk about gender and sexuality and say, well, this is why it's condemned because here's, you know, St. Paul says this. But there wasn't kind of the serious work being done, or maybe serious body of work to draw on as there was in the Catholic faith. Like that's what I found when I began just my kind of cursory exploration. So I really couldn't remain, I mean, evangelical Christian and answer this question in a way that satisfied me to any real depth. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So when I began to get interested in feminist and gender questions, initially I did so as an evangelical. And so the most substantive stuff on offer would be things like the Christians for Biblical Equality, right? These kind of egalitarian evangelicals. And they would write substantive stuff, but it was all about exegesis. So it was all about, This is how we interpret the Bible correctly, right? So there wasn't a lot of theological richness, right? Because it was still very, you know, because that's for an evangelical, that's what you got to do. You got to really wrestle with scripture. And that's important work, but I think I wanted more, but I had no idea about the Catholic tradition on this at all. So wanting more substance, wanting something more theological and philosophically rich, I thought the only other game in town was just, you know, like feminist theology and feminist philosophy, which again tends to be much more suspicious toward divine revelation and scripture and seeing those things not as authoritative, but primarily as man-made. And emphasis on the man, man-made, you know, and, you know, there was like one semester when I was at Oxford as a junior undergrad, and I was doing a course on medieval women's writing, and I was reading Hildegard, Christine de Pisan, Julian of Norwich. And I was like, I loved it. I feel like I got this glimpse. It was like this kind of like world opened up, and I was like, this is amazing, you know, and but then it just, I didn't enter into it until over 10, you know, about 10 years later, almost. I think I didn't quite realize that, oh, that tradition is still exists, you know, like it's not just this medieval thing. Like there's that thread has continued. But I didn't encounter that continuity until later.
Yeah. Well said. So one of the goals of a show like this is to present kind of a Catholic view of gender. You know, for those non-Catholic listeners, those completely non-Christian listeners, I want to always be able to try to explain topics to that point of view. And I mentioned before, I passed on your article from the Church Life Journal to so many people because it was just such a good explainer on the idea of gender and sexuality. And one of those things that I think in this term, thinking about gender, I mean, we're consumers of Disney and Netflix. We read books, we watch debates or watch laws being passed, and we hear about human rights being debated and how news content is reported, and all these things that we consume as listeners of this show or consuming this show right now, it's all coming through a lens, and that lens has a certain understanding of gender. And you know, what awoke in me when I'm thinking my own conversion to Catholicism is I realized, oh, wait, there's more paradigms out there than just evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. Well, there's more paradigms out there than just the Disney, Netflix, you know, news media kind of paradigm that's reporting these things and making these shows and miniseries and people writing books. There's a Catholic paradigm of gender that's different than, I think, the paradigm of gender that most people, say, in Western world, the modern world, in quotes, understand. And so your book does for me is it says, hey, here's a different paradigm than the one maybe you're operating under, and explains where this comes from and explains it really well. Can you do that for us here?
Sure.
Can you give me a little bit, in all seriousness, a bit of an explainer of how the current kind of paradigm of gender is different in a nutshell from how the Catholic Church understands gender. For the person who's just tuning in and going, like, what? What's the difference? How is it different?
Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. You know what I mean? Right. So I think there's a big difference. And I think the way you explain that is really helpful because, I don't know, sometimes I'll get pushback, say, from more progressive Catholics about my work and saying, no, we just need to listen to trans people about this. Like, we just need to listen to their experiences. And I'm like, yes, we do. Absolutely. We should listen to people's experiences. But we also have to be attentive to the way that our experiences are filtered through interpretive frameworks. Right, yeah. So there, it's not just this raw material. So there's a specific interpretive framework that has arisen in our culture that mediates or explains our experiences to ourselves. So there's, and then those experiences can reinforce the framework as the framework kind of gives shape to those experiences or interprets them for us. And so I think it's that framework that I really try to address in my work. Like, what exactly is this framework? What is it taking for granted? What is its view of the world? And so to do like a real rough sketch of the gender paradigm, as I call it in the book. So the gender paradigm, one, it denies the idea of a creator. So it's either explicitly atheistic or implicitly atheistic. So there's no, or if there is some kind of deity, there isn't a creator who intentionally creates us, and there isn't thus a created order, and we're not creatures, right? So that's very different. So in the gender paradigm, we are the creators. Like, we are the ones who are responsible for our own self-determination, for our own meaning. We don't receive our identity or our nature from the creator. We have to, almost craft our own nature, right? So that's a difference. And so in the gender paradigm, any kind of meaning or categorization is seen as this human construct, this process of human socialization, especially through language. And so how we do that work of creating is both technological, but it's also linguistic. It's also conceptual. So we can play with language because there isn't this intrinsic meaning, this right. givenness to the world. Like, any kind of meaning in the world exists because of us. So that's a difference. And then freedom is conceived in this paradigm as that process of self-determination, that process of pushing beyond limits. Like, that's what freedom is. It's surpassing our limits. Whereas from a Catholic perspective, freedom is found from a sense of belonging, from actually paying attention to our limits and trying to live within them, like in the context of this holistic created order of which we are a part. And that God actually works through even our limits and flaws. They're not something to be conquered, right? But they're, so I would say that, to even put it maybe in more of a nutshell, that the gender paradigm rejects the idea of nature as not just in like trees and bees, but like human nature. Like, there's this nature to things, and the good life is found through living in harmony with that, which is that's a very central idea in most ancient forms of thinking, like whether it's Stoicism, whether it's Taoism, whether it's, just living in harmony with the way, the Tao, rather than trying to fight against it. So those would be some. And then within those different frameworks, and then that changes what gender and sex are, right? If gender and sex are just these arbitrary categories that have been imposed by human beings, then we can kind of reimagine what it means to be a woman. If a woman is just primarily a construct, then we can, we can identify into that construct, right? So the view of the body then is different, right, because of these things. So in a Catholic understanding, the body is sacramental. It's what reveals the person. It's a gift. And part of our our being, right? To a human being as a unity of body and soul. We're not just a ghost in the machine. But in the gender paradigm, the body doesn't have an intrinsic meaning. And it's much more seen almost as this object. It's more of a dualistic kind of framework.
So talk to me through the idea of sex versus gender, because, and you do this very well in the book, but again, I don't know that I've encountered many people in any circles that I can think of, and I have different people in different circles, professional and private and friends and social places, that really seem to use these terms consistently or use these terms to mean the same thing sometimes. We're often, I think, and I think you do a great job of trying to bring this conversation down to the same level, we're often, I think, talking above or beside each other because we're just using these terms differently. So, I mean, what do we mean when we talk about sex versus gender? I know that there's definitely mm-hmm. Catholic implications of what those things mean and how we understand those, but is there a way to explain those two ideas and maybe how the world uses them versus how we in the Catholic Church would use those differently?
Yes. I would say if there's one thing that I find consistently maddening, it is how people use the terms sex and gender, even the phrase sex and gender. So
sorry.
Let's start with, no, I do it too. I mean, it's really, anyway, I'll get into it, but let's start with the classic second wave distinction, because that was really is the most prominent one for a long time. And there are still people, it's still in the air. So that idea is basically that sex refers to biology, and then gender refers to these cultural norms and expressions that we attach or associate with biology, right? So I'm female. The fact that I'm wearing my hair this way or these earrings, that's gender, right? Whereas, the fact that I have a uterus is sex. But I live in a culture where, females often are that sex is expressed through these gendered norms, right? So that's sort of the traditional sex versus gender. And you still hear this. You still hear this idea, well, gender is just a social construct. Okay, so hold on to that thought for a second. Now we have this new understanding of gender in what I call gender identity theory. And that is the idea that gender is a subjective sense of self as a man, a woman, or both, neither. And that's what gender is. So those are very different ideas. One is external. One is internal. One comes through a process of socialization explicitly. One seems to almost be pre-social, so much so that a four-year-old can realize this about himself, even though he's been socialized in the opposite way. There's this gender, this core that's real, that's not connected to his body, that he can access and know somehow just through this sense of self. So those are two very different ideas. But what happens is this super, it's so frustrating. It annoys me so much. Those two concepts are mashed together. Like if you look, for example, just one example, it's all over the place if you start paying attention, but the most recent Associated Press guidelines for writing about gender stuff, they, in their definition of what gender is, they have this, it's something like, gender is a social construct that encompasses one's appearance, behavior, and internal sense of self. So it just kind of shoves it all together into this one thing. But then, scroll down a couple pages, it says gender identity, and it gives the definition that I just gave, and subjective sense of self also can just be called gender. So it's okay, so those two things are actually saying very different things and making very different assumptions. Because if gender is just a social construct, then it actually doesn't make that much sense why we would block a 10-year-old's puberty, and consider really invasive medical procedures. Unless they're, but that's not the language that's used for that. That's more the gender identity language, right? So there's a lot of conflation happening. And to make it more complicated, then what happens is you will hear people who are proponents of the gender paradigm say, It's important to make a distinction between sex and gender. But then they will proceed to completely conflate sex and gender in a way that folds sex into gender. So they will say that someone's assigned gender is female, for example. Well, female is a word that used to indicate sex, but now basically any sex-based category is being attributed to gender, and then gender is being defined apart from the body. And so gender is just kind of this amorphous, like postmodern juggernaut word that just swallows all meaning. And, you know, it's like this eel that you can't quite grab with your hands. And so then it can almost mean anything you want it to mean. So it's just conceptually, it's just a hot mess.
Yeah. It seems like that. And you kind of, I don't know, I kind of feel like maybe I'm very, very trusting towards authority more than I should be, or I give you a benefit of the doubt more than I should. But I feel like somebody should be in charge of this, know what's going on and have some kind of overarching idea.
Where genders are.
You know what I mean? Like of what we're thinking and how we're processing things. But I guess I'm a bit naive to think that there is like a narrative that the world is following. It seems like the narrative is kind of a bit lost in this area.
Yes.
Certainly.
Yes.
Right? There's no one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm even like, the inconsistency seems so obvious to me and glaring, like this gender is a social construct and gender is this like innate sense of self. Then I'm like, okay, this can't be as dumb as it sounds, this equivocation, basically that's what's happening. There's this equivocation between what gender is. It's like, it's a social construct and it's this innate sense of self, you know, and then people just don't even really try to square that circle. But I just pull, you know, I have these gender textbooks from like major presses like Oxford University Press. And so I pulled one off the shelf the other day and I was like, I'm going to look through here and see how they... And sure enough, like on page 20, it says, you know, gender is a social construct, blah, blah, blah. Like, and then, you know, flip a few pages later, it starts talking about transgender identities. And then it's like, gender identity is an innate sense of self that, you know, I'm like, and there was no attempt to explain how those ideas cohere, right? Because you could, I mean, I can see making the argument that, well, of course, we internalize social norms, right? We internalize social constructs all the time. That's sort of Judith Butler's point, you know, the kind of queen of gender theory. But the way people talk about gender identity isn't just an internalized. That's why you can have a 4-year-old boy who says he's a girl, even though he's been socialized as a boy. There's something, that innate sense of self, that's more real than the body. You know, that's what gender really is. And that is very different from the idea that gender is a social construct. So anyway, but I want to write more about this because it's driving me crazy.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah, you're getting fighting.
That's great. I'm sorry. I'm not being cordial.
That's okay. It's okay. I wonder how the church, or I shouldn't say the church, how we as Catholic Christians respond to this kind of thing. How do we understand, or how do we, I guess, first of all, dialogue cordially with somebody who is in this kind of paradigm, right? That paradigm that seems a little bit confused or a little bit inconsistent about gender and sex and gender identity. How do we make sure we're talking on the same plane as Catholics to explain what the church believes, what we as Catholics believe? Is there a, how do we make that bridge there, that connection?
Well, you know, if you're trying to have an honest conversation with someone about this, you know, I would ask to define terms. You know, like sometimes, and I can tell this sometimes too, like if I remember in one of my interviews or something, someone asked, well, you know, I keep hearing gender is a spectrum. Is gender a spectrum? And I was like, well, do you mean gender or sex? Because I would answer those questions differently, you know, like, so I think if you hear someone say like gender is a social construct, you're like, okay, what do you mean by gender? Like, what, you know, explain this, you know, just ask questions. Like what do they actually mean? Define your terms. I think when it comes to like the law and policy, it should all be sex-based, especially if it's dealing with anything where physiology matters, like sports or prisons or, you know, just legal protections, right? Like those, that should just be sex-based, honestly, because it doesn't, there's no reason to divide sports teams by inner senses of self, Right. Like there's no reason to divide it like that. There's a logic to divide it according to physiology, however. So it seems like, okay, that should be sex-based. But yet I do think that sex is like not it. The thing that I think gender could be, if it were correctly understood, if gender is seen as, if sex is seen as this biological level, and then gender is the personal level that includes the biological, but also the spiritual, also the sociocultural, then it could actually be a really helpful concept. Like if gender is still connected to generation, like that's the root of the word, gens, then I think gender can be used helpfully. But it's such a messy word right now that every time I use it, I kind of cringe because I'm like, you know, it's so hard to be make yourself understood because people hear I say the word gender and you they might think 10 different things.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Look, I'm going to get fighty here for a minute, even though it's the cordial Catholic.
Feisty Catholic. Yeah, tonight. Yeah, that's what we're doing.
I should rename the show just this episode and then I'll
get back on my interview.
I like it. I think oftentimes and the Catholic response to this is just to double down on this idea that no, men are men, women are women. This very kind of harkens back to a different time kind of idea of gender roles and gender, you know, sexuality that I don't know. It's tough to present that to the world in a kind and cordial way. Like it's an over response in I'll leave my cards on the table here. Honestly, I'm a guy who has taken off time to be with the kids when they were young. I've taken, you know, paternity leave. I've taken them to school and I drive them around in the minivan. I think, and I'm saying that because I think there's a response sometimes that's like, okay, this gender spectrum thing is confusing. I'm a Catholic man. I'm a Catholic woman. These are our clearly defined roles. And I think that is the wrong response, like an over response. Is that, I'm getting fighty, but does that make any sense?
It's so funny. You're so Canadian because you're still being so nice.
I feel really fighty though. Aren't I being rude?
No, you're not. I think yes. I mean, I think too often those reactions are just the different, it's just two sides of the same coin, right? Okay. Because it's still defining what a man is and what a woman is in more external things like appearance or roles, you know, whether you work inside the home, whether you work outside the home, right? These things that are in some cases kind of arbitrary depending upon what country you were born into or, you know, just things that are outside of our control, right? But from a Catholic understanding, if womanhood and manhood are always grounded in the body, like that's the ground of what it means to be a woman. That's the ground of what it means to be a man. And then masculinity is the living out of being a male human being in the world. So that can look many different ways, right? But I think it's really important that that gender is always refers to persons, not to traits, not to roles, not to outfits, you know, but that that it's really fundamentally about embodiment. Because even, you know, my husband has been a stay-at-home parent for a while too. And when he's parenting, he's still doing that as a man. That is still an expression of his fatherhood and his masculinity, right? And, you know, when I do things like mow the lawn, which I recently discovered is actually kind of enjoyable, I went to like 38 years not mowing a lawn. And I was like, oh, it's kind of satisfying. But it's not like I'm suddenly masculine, you know, like I that's a feminine action because I am a female person. That's doing it. I'm a female body that's doing it. So, I think that reactions against this stuff, while they might be understandable, they often overcorrect by reinforcing some of the same stereotypes that both sides agree to.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's, yeah, thank you. That's well said. And I think it's hard for me, and I think people who are looking into the Catholic Church who are just moderate people, reasonable Christians who are kind of living life and trying to follow Christ and live well, live peaceably, to find this kind of middle ground of what the church kind of actually presents. Because I feel like there's on one side this idea, you know, on social media of, okay, we have the experiences matter, we'll honor those. That's the important thing. And kind of stretching the church's teaching as far as it can possibly go to say it's the experience of what matters, and that's fine. You know, everything else that we believe as Catholics in the catechism and the church has passed on through tradition, it can be molded or malleable, but it's experience that matters, right? Bringing people in without really explaining what the church teaches in an honest and earnest way. I think that's maybe one side. And the other side is this extreme overreaction on the other side. So I feel like it's just hard to find. I mean, gosh, the people that I've on both sides have to had a mute on Twitter because I can't stand the back and forth with either of these sides. I feel like I'm trying to, you know, read the catechism, read the tradition, understand the Catholic faith as a Catholic who honestly seeks just the middle ground of what the church actually teaches. And there's these loud voices on both sides that are really pushing the envelope on both sides. So honestly, you to me seem like the person who's just trying to live with the faith and present this in a reasonable way. I don't know if the middle ground is the right way of saying that, but how do we find that? Like, how do we, other than just reading all your books and just whatever you put out, we just read and consume it. And then we're a weird cult.
Oh man. But yeah, don't do that.
You know what I mean? Like it seems like with the noise of social media, there's just not that middle ground easily found, right? Of just actual what the church teaches.
Yeah. I joined Twitter in, I don't know, like a year and a half ago, something like that. Maybe a year ago. And at first I was like, okay, I'm going to like really carefully curate who I follow so that it's really balanced, you know? And I still think that's in general a good rule. But then I quickly realized like, oh, this is just this. I kind of had this realization like, oh, I shouldn't form myself through Twitter at all. Like that should not be my goal. Right. Like, and so I'm realizing that doesn't have this magical effect of like, you know, listening to kind of two divisive like voices who happen to be on opposite sides does not actually help form me as a moderate necessarily. So I think that we have to be formed by things not on social media. Right. So, and what everything I think, like I have really been formed by reading thoughtful Catholics, you know, like John Paul II, Edith Stein, you know, Sister Prudence Allen. Like there are a lot of substantive, measured voices out there that don't get caught up in the polarized insanity. Because that's really what the problem, you know, it's just this political polarization that's kind of ripping both of our countries asunder. And then it just gets, you know, the faith gets translated through that framework, right? There's another, you know, kind of interpretive framework, right? So trying to not get sucked into that particular framework, and it's difficult, but it's really important, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. You talk in a chapter called Artifice about transgender ideas. And I think this is so, it's so interesting. You mentioned your own experience of puberty, which is hilarious. And I won't bring that up. And it's really, really funny and awkward to read. I love that. But, you know, I've had listeners reach out to me to cover a topic like this. And your name always comes up. So I'm glad you came back and made time for us. Thank you. Because this is such a, I don't know, phenomenon, such a huge growing thing. I mean, I can had a listener write in with details on a survey of a local school board who surveyed kids in that school board, and something like 75% of the high school students in that school board reported that they didn't match their given like gender identity. Like 75% are self-reporting this, which was just hard to understand as a, you know, from a statistics point of view. I'd like to, that's confusing. Those numbers don't seem like how was that survey done? There's a lot of questions with that, but it seems like something is going on here that's really a phenomenon, like really seriously sweeping through society in a really serious way. Like, and I don't think that I really recognized that until I saw things like this, that, that the kids that are being formed under this kind of paradigm, well, a lot of them feel like they're really confused or don't seem to match what, you know, their biology is saying, or mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, I'm using the wrong words probably, but what are we to make of this with as and respond to this kind of thing as Catholic Christians? Like, what do we do with this? Because it seems, I don't know, big, like a real thing going on.
It is a real thing, and it's a big thing. It is this, it's really remarkable to look at the numbers, you know, of just how much exponential increase there has been in young people, especially experiencing gender incongruence or identifying as trans or non-binary. My guess is in that 75%, there's probably a large number of those that are not necessarily identifying as trans, but it's more, you know, about gender nonconformity, being maybe genderqueer or non-binary, and basically just like, I'm not cis, you know, whatever. I'm not cisgender. I'll be anything but that. So I think for a lot of these kids, it will be a phase. What worries me, and the reason why I've really invested a lot of time writing about this in a serious way, is that, you know, there have always been different kind of social pathologies among teenagers and adolescents, right? Especially females. Like, this is not something new in that sense, that adolescents under distress tend to externalize that distress in some way. Whether it's, you know, anorexia or self-harm, you know, but what's frightening about this is that for the first time, we have all the adults in the room, all the people who should know better, the doctors, the therapists, the teachers, the parents, in some cases, all echoing back and mirroring back. Yes, this is exactly right. This framework is right. And let's go on a path of medicalization, because that's what worries me. Because if a young person is ushered into a path of irreversible medicalization as a minor, then it can't just be a phase.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's not something that you can come back from, you know. It's not like being goth for a couple of years. And that's what really worries me. Right. Because I think there's a mental health. I mean, there is a mental health crisis among teenagers. Like, that's well documented. Yeah. Just rates of anxiety and depression were already, you know, just skyrocketing before COVID even accelerated the phenomenon. So young people are not doing well. But now we have this framework that's, you know, being imposed on a whole range of different circumstances, kinds of distress, discomfort. I mean, what person going through puberty doesn't feel at odds with their body, right? That's a very, especially, you know, young women, like, accepting one's body as a woman is like, it's a hard fought battle, you know, it's a hard won battle in our culture. But now there's this interpretive framework that's saying, oh, this is what you feel, then this is what you are, and here's how to fix it. Here's the solution to your suffering. Everything, all the kinds of distress you're feeling right now is all about this one thing. And if you just fix that thing, then you'll be happy. I mean, it's a really compelling story. But the problem is, it's based on very low quality, flimsy scientific evidence and a false understanding of the human person, a fragmented understanding of the human person. And so it does further damage to these young people. That's why I write about this stuff. It's not because I don't like trans people. It's actually because I care about them. Right. And I think that they deserve better care that is not just driven by ideology. And, you know, as part of my research, like, I've read the studies, like, I've read them all, and there's just, you know, the simplistic narrative that this kind of medicalization solves gender dysphoria is just not well supported. You know, the supposed benefits don't outweigh the clear risks, and it's It's not good, especially when we're talking about young people. Like, we're talking about minors, you know?
Yeah. I mean, is there a clear reason why it seems like this is being accepted if the evidence and the research is not is as poor as you say? Like, why, you know, we're supposed to be a science-based society, right? I mean, we mm-hmm. the new atheists ushered in this era of God is dead because science is the thing, right, that wins the day. So why does it seem so unscientific? Mm.
I mean, I think it's that everything's become politicized, right? And so this issue specifically, it's being seen as this urgent and politicized matter. And right. so I think even people who are operating out of goodwill, you know, it's like they have these kind of blinders on, you know, and it's fascinating sometimes to read some of the studies where, you know, read a study and you know, they'll find some kind of shred of low quality evidence, like, oh, like this factor is approaching statistical significance, you know, and then they'll kind of in the discussion leap to this grandstanding about like transphobic legislation. And it's like, but that's not what a scientific article right. should be doing. Right. Like, you should just be looking at the evidence. And so there is this, there's this healthy skepticism that should be present is absent on this issue. And I think, you know, in Europe, things are changing. So a lot of European countries that have been down this road for a while are now changing their therapeutic approaches to young people. Sweden, the UK, France, Finland, all like just most of them just in the last couple of years have done independent reviews of the evidence and have concluded that, that the risks do not outweigh the supposed benefits. Or vice versa. Yeah. But America's just like, oh, and Canada, man, let me tell you, Canada's the worst of them all. Yeah. Like, you know, there's just recklessly going ahead. And I think it's certainly in an American context, I think because it's now politicized and it's now it's like you're on your tribe's side. Like, that's what it is. Like, oh, I'm a progressive. And so this is how my tribe sees it. And that's like this tribal loyalty. You know, people just dig their heels in and, you know, you only listen to the voices that echo back what you want to hear. And
Is there a singular Catholic response to this, to the transgender movement phenomenon? I don't know that I don't want to downplay this as a phenomenon. People are experiencing this. There's something happening here. I don't want to minimize the experience of those people, but by calling it a phenomenon or something, that seems rude, and I'm cordial. So is there a Catholic response to somebody who says, I'm transgendered, I'm doing this surgery, I'm taking these pills, I'm changing my identity, my biology, I'm having these surgeries? Is there a Catholic response to those kinds of conversations? Like, well, there's the tribal response. I get that. Like,
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Right. I don't think that's a healthy thing. Is there a healthy response?
Yeah. Well, I think so for sure. I mean, I think there's different layers to this question, right? Because there's like the bioethical question, right? So yes, Catholic bioethicists have written about this, from that perspective. So you can address the question there, and that will be more about, you know, philosophical and theological anthropology and principles and medical evidence, right? That question. Yeah. But then you have like the pastoral level. And that's different, right? That's interpersonal, right? So I think when it comes to the pastoral level, there isn't just one response because there isn't just one person going through this, right? Like each person who's going through this, you know, there's no one like monolithic trans experience. So, you know, it really requires an attention to the person and what they're going through. And, you know, it's like that question Jesus likes to ask people, like, what are you looking for? Yeah, you know, that's what he wants to know. And, so I think that the path of accompaniment is the response, right? Which is hard because it's playing the long game. It's patient. It's a little more hands off. It's a little more like docile to the spirit. while also having a specific direction, which is more, you know, a journey toward the Father, like, yeah, to, you know, into truth, right? So it's not, I mean, Pope Francis talks about accompaniment, like, and he uses these words, he says it's not a sort of therapy supporting self-absorption. So it's not, accompanying someone is not just saying, tell me, you know, tell me your experience and I will just affirm absolutely everything, right? So accompaniment can include, like, accompaniment is basically like, I'm with you in this, I'm here. And, you know, sometimes we might disagree, but if we do, it's because I care about your ultimate good. But whatever happens, I'm still going to be here. I'm not going to reject you. And, you know, I'm here with you as you, like, discern this. And we might disagree, but I love you nonetheless. You know, I mean, that seems to be more of the kind of pastoral response. I think it's also helpful in discerning how to approach accompaniment to consider one's role or sphere of responsibility toward another person. So if you're a teacher, for example, especially of minors versus maybe if you're teaching adults, I think that's an important distinction, because I think parents of minors, teachers of minors should be more cautious in unthinkingly affirming this stuff because of the risk of unnecessary medicalization of a young person, right? So I think they're, you know, the stakes are higher in some ways there. I think also, you know, if like a priest has a different role of responsibility toward a parishioner than I would as a fellow parishioner, like as a fellow parishioner, you know, I actually went to Mass the other day and there was a trans-identified man who was sitting like two pews ahead of me. You know, so he was, you know, presenting as a woman and, you know, he looked very nice. He had this nice suit on, his nails were done. And, you know, he left right before the end of Mass. Otherwise, you know, my plan was to just go and introduce, you know, just say, hi, we're new here. What's your name? And that would have been it. Like I would, you know, because it's not, he's not under like my authority or something. Right. And, and I want, like when I see a trans person in Mass, like I want to make sure that they are recognized and welcomed, you know? And, cause that's what it is. In some ways it's like, you know, Jesus is like calling people to himself. And so Jesus is calling all he's calling trans people to himself. And so in some ways what we need to do is just not get in the way of that, you know, not mess it up.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's so well said. And so I think wise to point out, Abby, that person's not under your authority, your teaching authority, your pastoral authority, you're a fellow parishioner. And gosh, I think like that response of accompaniment is beautiful, right? When you understand, it's not just going to mean, as you said, as you quoted Pope Francis, them just going into themselves and just talking with themselves all the time. You're accompanying them. You're walking with them. You're a person in that relationship. You might disagree, but you have these conversations and walking toward, you know, with that goal in mind of bringing them to Christ, bringing them to the Father. I just think of my experiences with like anxiety and sometimes crippling anxiety. I think of how hard that is for somebody who's in a body that they feel like is not the body that fits them. That's a difficult experience. And that accompaniment, that is the thing versus, I don't know what else you do. You look the other way, you yell at them, you give them some pamphlets or something, like you live your life on the attack, on the assault against this other camp that's not you, right? I think that versus the accompaniment response of understanding, of place of empathy. I mean, that's the thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 I want to end with just one thought, because you talk about this in the book. The Catholic Christian holds a twofold truth, you say, the dignity of every human being and the dignity of the sexed human body, and that the transgender anthropology requires the rejection of one of these truths. Can we explore that for a minute? The idea that, you know, the Catholic Church holds this one idea, the transgender anthropology requires the rejection of one of those truths the Catholic Church holds. How do we grapple with that, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I mean, I think what I'm saying there, I'm like, wait, what did I
think
say?
I think I just probably misquoted you terribly.
No, I'm like, what did I write again? Well, it sounds like a transgender anthropology rejects the dignity and inherent meaning of the sex body, right? Because it kind of, I mean, another way of putting it might be the sacramentality of the body, because in a Catholic understanding, the body is a sacrament that reveals the person, right? It's through my body that the invisible world of my thoughts and who I am and my personhood are made manifest in order for me to have community with others. And so the body's always doing that. Like, the body doesn't have to be forced to do that. And so I think that what I hear in some transgender narratives is this desire for that sacramentality, is a desire for the body to reveal the person. But I think the difference is that in Catholicism, like, because our bodies are gifts from the Creator, that the body we have is already serving that sacramental function. And so I think a rejection of the body, or a rejection of the body as a gift, as having an inherent dignity and meaning, that is at odds with a Catholic understanding of anthropology. But as far as then how to kind of navigate that with someone, well, I mean, in some ways I think about, I mean, this isn't that unlike interacting or engaging with someone from a different philosophical or religious perspective, right? Like, they're coming at it from a different perspective. But that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, have community with that person, have a relationship with that person, treat them with love and respect. And, you know, if the door opens, have rich theological conversations with them. So yeah, in some ways I think, I don't know. I think we need to give people space to go toward the truth slowly. You know, I think human beings are really impatient, especially when, like, we've had a powerful conversion and we, like, want other people to be converted now, you know. It's like, well, you know, my own conversion was, you know, I became Catholic still, you know, like, when I first joined the church, there were parts of the creed I wouldn't say, you know. And there was no one, like, coming at me hard saying, like, I heard you didn't say that line in the creed, like, you shouldn't be going to commun-, you know. It's just, so I was given space to kind of wrestle through with some of this. But then when I would go to my, you know, Catholic friend and be like, okay, what's the deal with this contraception thing? They would answer honestly. Yeah. And sometimes I didn't like that answer. Sometimes I would be like, I don't like that. You know, I don't agree with that. But they told me, you know, they answered my question, and it didn't change their attitude toward me whatsoever. So that, when I think about that experience, that to me seems to be a model of accompaniment, you know, just building a relationship with someone, a rapport. And then if, you know, the conversation gets theological, speaking honestly, but lovingly, and then letting that person, you know, think about what you said. So there's no quick fix, you know, there's no quick fix with the human heart. That's not how these things work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Well said. The book is The Genesis of Gender from Ignatius Press. It's fantastic. So thank you again for putting those thoughts onto paper. Do you want to point people anywhere else to find your stuff or to follow you? Where should they go? On Twitter, obviously, to follow you, because you love being there.
I don't know, man. I always hate this question, because I'm like, I can't in good conscience, like, encourage someone to follow me on Twitter. You know, it's like, I don't know. If you're already on Twitter and you're bored, you can follow me. I do try to post, when I write something, I do try to post it there. So that is one way to follow my writing. But that's the only social media imprint I have. I try to not get too deep in that stuff. But so.
Well, that sounds great. Well, your books are on Amazon or from Ignatius Press. People can find them, find them there. And they're great. Thank you for coming back after all these years.
You've grown. Yeah, so. I've
grown. Yeah. Well, that's what COVID does to you.
I know, right? We're like these haggard, you know, oh. Like, oh, man. Yeah, yeah.
Yep, that's about right. Thanks for being here. I want to say, you know, God bless you and the work you're doing. Thanks for being a place that people can come to read a well-reasoned and informed view of these things. In a place there's a lot of noise and a lot of chatter and a lot of, can I say crap on the show? I guess it's my show. I could say crap.
Oh my gosh. You are just letting loose tonight.
I feel a little bit fighty. Yeah.
Cordial no more.
I'll have to mark this episode explicit, I think, and apologize in advance when I record.
Please do.
The intro. Oh, sorry, guys.
I love it so much. Yeah, oh my gosh.
I'm really sorry. Thanks for being here, Abby. Yeah. I really appreciate it. It's been great. So thank you so much.
Thank you. All right.
Bye. Well, friends, thank you for listening to the episode with Abigail Favalli. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope that was informative, helpful. I really do hope that we're speaking from a place of true Catholic faith and understanding what the church actually teaches. Empathy, sympathy, respect, love, dignity, upholding the truths of the Catholic faith and accompanying those who may not believe what we believe exactly or present things differently or present a different version of the Catholic faith. Gosh, I hope this was what I meant it to be. It seems like it was a good episode. Hopefully you enjoyed it too. Reach out, cordialcatholic@gmail.com, and let me know what you think. We're on Instagram and on Twitter at Cordial Catholic. TheCordialCatholic.com is our website, and The Cordial Catholic on Facebook. Your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify are very important. Please do leave those if you can. Those help to push the podcast out to new people. And to support this show, if you feel led in that direction, head over to Patreon at patreon.com/cordialcatholic or paypal.me/cordialcatholic for a one-time donation as well. And thank you in advance. Thanks for listening, folks. If you like this show, please do pass it on to a friend. Let them know that they should hear this, too. I think it's a valuable episode to pass around. If you think so, tell a friend. That's one of the best ways of passing on this kind of thing, is just to tell somebody, text them, email them. Hey, call them on the phone and say, hey, Cordial Catholic episode, whatever and whatever. Take a listen. That'd be great, folks. And thank you for listening week after week. I do appreciate that. And please do pray for me. Pray for the show. We're praying for you too. Take care, guys. Talk to you again next week. Thanks so much, and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.